Well, good morning, everyone. Now you sat through two classes. Are you still awake? Sort of. Yes, Randy, I can see you over there. All right, Zechariah's night visions. I don't know whether I mentioned yesterday, but the night visions, we actually think what happened with the night visions is they were all given in one night. It all happened in one night. You can imagine how excited Zechariah would have been to come out and talk to people the next day. It actually would have been quite an interesting discussion to listen to him tell us all about what he had seen. I thought today, at least, we don't have quite as much material to cover today. Yesterday was a lot with all the background information and try to get through the first vision. For those of you that have been asking about our family, I'll at least point out to you who our family is. That happens to be Sue right there, which hopefully you'll recognize. And I don't know who the old guy is right there. But that's our oldest son, Steve. He married Felicity, and they are now living in Australia. She was an Australian, and they live south of Sydney in Wollongong. We were just over to see them a couple months ago. Second boy is Paul. He married Frank Abel's daughter, MJ, and they're now living in Michigan. They're the only one of our family, at least, left in Michigan still. Then Rebecca, our daughter Rebecca, is home right now in Simi Valley, and she's 33. She's autistic, though, and so she doesn't travel well in going to places like this and adjusting to new environments. Andrew over here, and the one on the end, he's an interesting character. He's our computer programmer. He's my technology man that I usually love to take with me, but now, unfortunately, he got married, so I can't take him along with me anymore. He's actually the one who designed LavoniaTapes.com, if you've ever used that before. He watched me copying tapes years ago for all the brothers and sisters in North America. I'd get them in from Australia, copy them, and send them out all over the place, and one day he came to me and he said, "Dad, you are so out of it." He said, "You are so out of it, there's no sense even going to CDs. You've just been so archaic in your approach." He said, "Look, I'll create a website for you. We'll change them all into MP3s, put them out there. You don't have to copy anything. People can just download them themselves." And I thought, wow, is that possible? And so he did. Anyways, that's great. That's been a great service to our community to have that. And then we've got Sarah over here. Sarah is living in Dubai right now. She's got an interesting job opportunity over there. And we're hoping at some point she'll come back to Simi Valley because she loves California. And who I got left over here? Oh, there's Nathan over there. So Nathan is the youngest, and he still lives with us in California, but he was out at Midwest Bible School at Hanover. And he'll be coming home hopefully in a few days after we get home. Andrew, he married Marjorie Binch. I don't know any of you know the Binches from Indiana, but that's Eddie Binch's daughter, Eddie and Beth Binch. They just got married back in June. And yes, we do have one granddaughter, for those of you that were asking yesterday. That is little Eden right there, and that's Paul and MJ's little girl. So that's our little family right there that God has blessed us with. And if you've never used LavoniaTapes.com, the way Andrew made the website is that he did more than I could ever anticipate. It's like that passage that God is able to do far more abundantly than all that we ask or think. He not only created a website that I could put all the stuff that I had on, but he made it so that all of you can upload things to the website. And people are doing this all around the world. So when you go somewhere and you record classes, people all over, UK, Australia, Africa, whatever, they could upload to this and add their classes to it. And if you thought that it was sort of like dying out over the last year because he hadn't upgraded the front page, just last week we finally got him to do that. And now the front page will show you in a list all the recent things that have been upgraded. So if you check it out again, it is up and operating, and it has been. It's just every so often the hoster messes us all up, and one time the host went down, and then they changed the whole setup, and he had to rewrite the programs. But it's been a great service to our community. All right, back to Zechariah. So, the job this week in Zechariah, my goal is to give you what some of these visions might mean. Your job is to figure out, as we go along every day, you have to remember them. So, yes, we are going to, by the end of the week, you're all going to be able to go through the visions, and you're going to see this isn't that hard to do. You're going to be able to go through the visions, just look at a little picture of them, and be refreshed in your memory about what did it mean. Why did Zechariah see this vision? So now you have the historical background. You realize that the Persian Empire had gone a little wacky for a while there when Gomedes took over. Some of the people had rebelled. Now the angels in chapter 1, the first vision, the brethren and sisters needed assurance that if they were going to get back to work, they needed assurance that God was going to be in this project. So, what's the first vision all about? Why do we have these fellas riding around on horses, coming back and reporting to the man and the horse and the red horse under the myrtle trees? What's it about? What had the horseman done? They have reestablished peace. They come back and report to the top angel. They come back and say, all right, you sent us out to bring about peace. We've done it. We rode out there and we took care of all those areas of the empire that were rebelling and there were little skirmishes going on. And we brought the empire back under control. We put Darius Hystaspes in charge. We now have stability in the Persian Empire. And they said, look, we've done our job. All right. Then the fella under the myrtle trees, what does he ask God? Because they did their job, right? How long? How long are you going to wait? We did our job. These angels were excited. They had gone out and done their work, and they wanted to know, how long are you going to wait until you again return to Jerusalem and restore the city? And so that's what the first vision was all about. And if you had heard Zechariah come in and tell you this the next day, that this is what's going on in heaven, this is what the angels are doing and how they feel about our project, they want us to get it done, they're excited about it, they're working behind the scenes, we can't see them, but they're out there working, I think that would have been very encouraging to the brethren and sisters at that time to get that first vision and realize this is what's going on. So, at the end of chapter 1 is the second vision in Zechariah. So you come down to the end, it's right around verse 18. So he raised his eyes and he looked up, and there were four horns. So he sees these four horns. And I said to the angel who talked with me, what are these? So he answered me, these are the horns that have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. And the Lord showed me four craftsmen, or some of the versions have carpenters. And I said, what are these coming to do? So he said, these are the horns that scattered Judah. So these four horns had scattered Judah and caused trouble in Judah so that no one could lift up his head. This was the problem back then, is that they were under this oppression of the power of the other nations, and they had been intimidated. The work had been made to stop. Remember back in Ezra that the Persian army came back in, and by force they made the work stop. But the craftsmen are coming to terrify them and to cast out the horns of the nations that lifted up their horn against the land of Judah to scatter it. Now, when you understand the historical context, you can start to see right away what God was trying to show these people. And these visions aren't real complicated, really. Most of them, they're not. So what Zechariah saw was the four horns, and he sees the four craftsmen. All right, and what happens is that the horns had been scattering. They had scattered the Jews, they had humiliated them, they had caused them all kinds of trouble. And now God says, I'm going to use these craftsmen. I'm going to use these fellas that were building the temple, and I'm going to terrify the nations around. That's the kind of support I'm ready to give you. And this would have been very encouraging to the people of Zechariah's time. When you go back and look at who the four horns may have been, it's possible you could try to identify them. Some of our writers do. We know that horns represent kings, their powers. That's the way they're used in Daniel and elsewhere. This, by the way, is typical of what you're going to see in Zechariah. You're getting all these hints of what some of the things in Revelation mean. So when you see horns show up in Revelation later on, I mean, no wonder they're coming out of Daniel and Zechariah. They were powers that would arise. And it could be that if you want to actually label them, if you look at, well, these four kings are responsible for scattering Israel. One thing you don't want to do, I think, is some of our writers have gotten confused in this crossover of the past and future stuff, and they try to line up the four horns with the four parts of Daniel's image, or the Daniel's beast. And they would go with like the Babylonians or the Assyrians, and then the Persians, and then the Greeks, and then the Romans. The problem with that is that it doesn't make sense back here. This vision had to make sense to these people, and the Greeks and the Romans were years down the line before they would ever even come. And it says in the record that these four horns had already scattered Judah and had caused trouble for them and intimidated these people. So if you want to go back and look at, well, who had done that over the past years, you could go back and pick out some of the Assyrian kings like Shalmaneser and Sennacherib, as you're looking at in Brother Jay's class, or maybe Pharaoh Necho back earlier, if you want to even pick some of the ones from down in Egypt, or and then up to Nebuchadnezzar. So you could actually line up some of these kings. But it may be possible that the four horns don't necessarily mean four specific kings as much as they represent the four divisions, the four areas geographically, that all these nations that have been causing you trouble, all these surrounding communities, the Samaritans, and all these people that have caused you problems, you are going to terrify them and they will be in fear of you. And you saw how this happened when we were looking at yesterday in Ezra chapter 5, that the king sends back the letter and says, all you guys that caused the trouble, stay away from the Jews and leave them alone. And now the Jews, the fear of the Jews, is falling on these people. And so this was God's promise that he would support the community and he would stick with them. When you go back and look at the word that's used for the carpenters or the craftsmen, most of the modern versions put in craftsmen right there, and you can see a bit why. If you go back and look at how the word was used in 1 Samuel 13 at verse 19, it appears to be more than just woodworkers. It's used that there was no blacksmith found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make swords or spears. So it really wasn't just a carpenter, although it could include carpenters. It appears the word is more general. It just meant like somebody who's like a craftsman today. They could be a craftsman of wood, craftsman of silver and gold or whatever. It could be a stone craftsman. These were the people that were the workers on the temple. Back in Ezra 7, it's interesting that they actually gave the money to the masons and the carpenters, and that is the same word. So you can make the connection back to Ezra and show that these people in the vision of Zechariah chapter 1, these carpenters or craftsmen, were the very people that had been working on the temple. They were the ones who were supposed to get the job done. And what God promised is that now he will stand behind them, and he will promise to help them, and he will be their support. So that he's going to use them to terrify the nations around so that they can get this temple finished. You'll notice in Zechariah, as you're going through this book, some of you probably have picked up on the fact that the word the Lord of hosts is used extensively in these visions and elsewhere throughout the book of Zechariah. The Lord of hosts, Yahweh of armies. In the book of Isaiah, as Jay's going through that, you'll notice it comes up quite a bit in Isaiah, 60 times. But Isaiah has 60 chapters, 66 chapters, all right? In Jeremiah, some of you may have noticed that it's used a lot of times in Jeremiah because Yahweh of armies was going to come in and he was going to yank his people out of the land and take them up to Babylon. But Jeremiah, 80 times you'll see that phrase, the Lord of hosts. But Jeremiah's long book, 52 chapters. Zechariah, the word occurs 50 times in only 14 chapters. Any ideas why? Just think of these people. What's the problem? The Persian army had come in and made them stop by force. So the government of the world had come in and stopped them. All the Samaritans around them had been intimidating them, writing letters to the king and trying to get them to stop, hired counselors against them. These people were afraid. And they needed the assurance that the Lord of hosts, Yahweh of armies, will stand behind you and he will give you the support that you need. Very similar to when Elisha, you know, said, open the eyes of that young man. He looked around and saw all the chariots that were there and saw the support system that was there. But brothers and sisters, these people had to believe it at a time in which there was no open manifestation of angels. It's just like today. Most of God's servants that are going to walk into the kingdom will have never known that they had talked to an angel. The vast majority of people would have never known that they ever saw an angel. And although angels may have appeared to them, we just don't know. You may run into people that are angels. See, the vast majority are going to be just like now, today. And we have to read the signs, watch what's happening, and realize that God is there. He's promised to help us in our time of need. And that's what he was going to do. He was going to protect these people if they would get back to doing the job that they were supposed to do. And so what happens over time is that the nations do learn to fear Yahweh, the God of the Jews. And you see this. You found back in Deuteronomy 2, that was the prediction that he had put back then before they went in the land. He said, it's going to be okay. You'll go in. I'll chase the people out with hornets. You're going to take over the land. And I'm going to put the dread and the fear of you, in Deuteronomy 2 at verse 25, upon the nations under the whole heaven, who shall hear the report of you. Remember how Rahab said, we've heard the report, right? She heard what God had done for the Jewish community in getting them out of Egypt. Deuteronomy 11, the same thing. No man will be able to stand against you in verse 25. The Lord your God will put the dread of you and the fear of you upon all the land where you tread, just as he said to you. Joshua 2, Rahab responded, I know that the Lord has given you the land, because she knew that the fear of them had fallen on those people. And in Esther chapter 6, which is really interesting because this is going to come just a few years after Zechariah's visions. Esther chapter 6. Look what happened as a result of the whole incident with Haman. Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. His wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you've begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him." And this is what happened through the events. God promised he would stand behind them, and he did. And the fear of the Jews began to fall upon these people. It did in the land, and it did amongst the nations. That's what angels can do. This is what they promised to do for us. Now, when you look at the long-term fulfillment of this, you can certainly see how this would apply in the latter days. Look at how nations have been terrifying the land of Israel. The Jews are always living in fear. The Jewish community sits there and they're surrounded by nations that are constantly being given weapons and being given the ability to cause the Jews trouble. They'll launch and just lob missiles at them, and they'll shoot stuff over the wall into the land of Israel, and they'll come in with terrorist weapons, and they'll bomb areas. And you look at how this is going on today. Well, God's promise to the Jews is that when he converts them, and two-thirds of the land will have to die in order to pull this off, the promise in Zechariah is that one-third are going to be converted, they're going to be put through those fires that Jay was talking about this morning and refined, and God will use Judah, he will use the Jews as his battle axe to conquer the Gentile nations and establish his kingdom. That was the prediction all along, and he said that later on in Zechariah 9, and it's also predicted in Jeremiah 51. Two books, which are great because one of them, Jeremiah, is looking at the time when they're going away captive and saying someday it will be different, and Zechariah is telling you now, after they've come back, that this is what God intends to do in the future. And at that time, the nations will learn to fear and respect the Jews. Remember how 10 men will grab hold of the robe of a Jew, saying, "Let us go with you, because we have heard that God is with you." And that's what God will do in the latter days. And again, use his nation, Judah. He's going to use these simple people in order to conquer the world and bring peace to the world and to establish his house. Now, in Zechariah chapter 2, you get into the third vision. So now we got the second vision down. Second vision's four horns and the four craftsmen. And you got to remember the craftsmen were the temple workers. And even though the horns had been terrifying them to this point, God says, "I'm going to use you people to terrify those horns. And I'll stand behind you and make sure that in the end they cower to you and that you will then be given the authority to finish this house." And Ezra chapter 5 is a good one to Bible mark on this because that's exactly when it happened. Ezra 5 is the historical record of when God fulfilled this vision. So in chapter 2 now, he looks up his eyes and he looked and behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand. So he's got a measuring line, or like we would call it tape measure. So this would be a big tape measure, though. It would be more like those kind that they have where you can pull out a string and like measure something fairly long. So he's got a measuring line in his hand. And so I said, "Where are you going?" So he said to me, "To measure Jerusalem, to see what is its width and its length." And then there was an angel who talked with me and going out. So the angel that talked with Zechariah starts heading out. All right. And then another angel was coming out to meet him. So the angel talking with Zechariah that had been communicating with him goes to leave Zechariah, and another angel comes out and talks to this angel. See, this is why I say that in Zechariah you get more interaction about how angels work together than any other Bible book. There's a little bit in Daniel, and you see a little bit in Genesis 18 and 19, but Zechariah is full of the work of the angels and lets us see how this plays out, how angels have different authority. Some angels know more than others. Angels come back and report to more important angels who in turn then go to God. I mean, you look at Micaiah's vision, and he sees the angels there up in heaven, and God's having counsel with the angels and asks for ideas. What do you think we ought to do? And an angel comes up with an idea, then that angel, go and do it, and he would take other angels then with him to carry that out. This is how it works in the divine counsel. This is what we have to look forward to, brothers and sisters, in the kingdom age. This is what our life in the kingdom is all about. Watch the angels. Watch how they act. Watch how they interact with each other and cooperate, and you'll find out what it's like to be in God's family today. These are those seraphim, the cherubim that Jay was talking about. I mean, they're there in the Bible so that we understand this is what God has invited you to do. He's offered us the opportunity to join the work of the angels and be part of his heavenly family, the whole family of God in heaven and on earth. Fun to watch. So in verse 3, this angel who talked with him goes out. Another angel is coming out to meet him. And this angel says to the other angel, "Run, speak to this young man, saying, Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls, because of the multitude of men and livestock in it. For I, says the Lord, will be a wall of fire all around here, and I will be the glory in her midst." Now, what's that about? See, what are the people afraid of? They're afraid of the Persian army. They're afraid of the Samaritans. They're afraid of all the trouble that has come their way over the last few years. And so if you're going to go out and work on God's house again, the fear was that if we go to work on God's house, we need protection. We need to, first of all, build the walls of Jerusalem. Can you imagine the arranging brethren having their little discussions and their debates about going out to work? And they'd get together, and groups of the Jews and the leaders would get together, and they'd say, "All right, what do you think? You know, maybe the political climate is good now. Darius Hystaspes is in power. Maybe we should get back to work. What do you think we ought to do first? Finish the temple or build the walls?" Remember what happened last time? They came in and they made a stop. What we really ought to do is build the walls. If we build the walls, we'll have protection against the Samaritans, the other nations, and then we'll be safe. And so that's what they were thinking. And so this third vision is specifically about handling that problem in the ecclesial community. For all of you that were out there thinking that you need to go out and build the walls, forget it. Zechariah is going to come and tell them, because God promises He will be, the angels, like in Elisha's vision, the chariots that had surrounded him of fire, God will be a wall of fire around the city of Jerusalem. I will be the glory in her midst, and I will protect the city. Forget about the walls. You don't need them right now, because I promise you, I'll protect the city. You're going to have the freedom to finish this house, and you will be able to build it without anybody causing you problems. And so Zechariah would come in and explain to the people, "This is what I saw. This is the promise God has made. Forget about working on the walls. We just need to finish God's house." And that would have helped to alleviate that ecclesial problem amongst the people that were wondering, what are we supposed to do? Finish the temple or build the walls of Jerusalem? So it's fun to watch that concept. So he sees the man with the measuring line. The guy's going to go out and he's going to measure Jerusalem. Now, for those of you that read Brother Mansfield's book and you're reading the expositor notes that he gave on this, he thought he was measuring Jerusalem to destroy it. I really don't think that's true at all. And you look at other writings and you look at the context of this chapter, this is all positive stuff. He's not measuring the city to destroy it. Sometimes in visions of prophecy, you will see a man with a measuring line about destroying a city when God's trying to destroy Jerusalem. But now he doesn't intend to destroy it. Chapter 1 said that he's going to turn to Jerusalem. He is going to rebuild it. And he's promising and encouraging these people that he's going to get the job done. So the man intends to measure Jerusalem about the walls. That's what he's trying to do. He wants to figure out, should we make these walls? Let's find out how big these walls are going to be and get all the supplies ready. So another angel comes out, and look at how these angels communicate to each other and how they accept the fact that in the angelic family of God, some angels will have more authority than others. And this angel that's talking with Zechariah is going out to meet the man, and the other angel comes and says to this angel, "Go stop him. Tell him you don't need to do this." And the angel does it. See how angels communicate with each other and how they cooperate? You don't ever find angels having arguments. They don't do that. I mean, Jehu's looking at Psalm 103, Psalm 104 about those seraphim. Did you see all those references? Psalm 103 at the end of the chapter. These angels, what do? They hearken to the voice of his word. They do his work. That's what they do. They don't argue with each other. When a higher angel says to a lower one to go out and do this, they do it. And in Daniel, when Michael and Gabriel are having that discussion, and Gabriel wants to go talk to Daniel, and he says, "Look, at the prince of Persia withstood me 21 days. I needed help. I called on Michael. Michael came over and took over that job for me. He helped me out so I could come and talk to you, Daniel." This is what angels do. This is how they get along with each other. And brethren and sisters, if we hope to join God's family, this is the time we have to practice this. This is when we get our opportunities to practice this in family life and ecclesial life. We're practicing to join God's family. So he's given us our nuclear families to practice. He's given us the ecclesial family to practice even more. But this is the practice to find out if he can allow us to join his family. His family in heaven and on earth, when they're all joined together. You look at those visions that Jay was looking at about the seraphim today in Ezekiel and in the different places that he went to. And you see how God's family is represented as the four living ones. And Ezekiel's chariot as it comes on down. And the things that they would do. And then in Revelation, you see the four living ones joined with the 24 elders and the angels. See, what's happened is God is trying to show us is that you've been offered the opportunity as the saints of this world to join the four living ones and join the family of God. It's a fascinating thing revealed in visions, that that's what he was trying to show. It isn't just about the saints of this creation. It's actually the whole family of God, and this is the practice time. This is why in our families, between mom and dad, husbands and wives, with kids and parents, this is the time to practice living like angels. Our job is to join God's family, and he's given us families to practice in. It's a great design. This isn't random chance that we ended up in families like this. He designed it all so that we would be able to practice to be a part of his family forever. And so how we behave with each other, God's looking at it. The angels are watching this to find out if we're ready for God's family. How do we behave in our ecclesias? You know, how do we behave with one another when we have conflict? How do we do that? And he's waiting to see, are we learning to be patient like the angels, to be compassionate, to be kind like the angels? They always come across that way because this is how God's family members live. And you see this in Zechariah and Daniel and Genesis. This is how angels behave. So that's the point of this vision, the man with the measuring line. And you can see the situation that these Jews would have been in. You go back and look in Ezra at what had actually happened at this point in time. There are only about 40,000 Jews back in the land. Ezra actually compiles the number and tells you there are about 42,000 of them at this time back in the land. And back in Ezra chapter 3 and 4 and 5, they had discouraged the people, hired counselors, worn them down. 16 years this had been going on. And people had gotten discouraged. And they were just wondering whether the project should continue. Can we really get it done? And finally, when Gomedes had come in for those 7 months, the Persian king had sent the army in and demanded that the work on the temple stop. And so a lot of these people back then were worried about security, they were worried about protection, and they were thinking walls around the city. And God had to get them out of that mode and start thinking about, wait a minute, I'll protect you, and I'll take care of you. So his reason is that, look, you don't need walls around the city right now because God's going to bless this city. There's going to be so many people in this city in the years to come. I'm going to fill my city again. I'm going to fill it with people and with animals. That's his intent, because he will be the wall of fire to protect the city. And just as though he had, you know, when you go back and look at the when the Babylonians had come in and the siege had occurred, some of these people could have been to tell stories about what that was like, what they had heard about the siege, how bad it had become when the Babylonians surrounded them. You read through Jeremiah's Lamentations of some of the bad things that occurred at that time, and people were forced to survive, and you know, people were eating their children just so they could survive. They were throwing bodies over the walls of the city because they didn't want disease in that. They remembered what that was like, and they knew about those stories. But this one, God says, I'll take care of you. And what he was looking for, brethren and sisters, is the one ingredient that he wants to find in us, and that's faith. We have to trust him. We have to believe that he is in control. Whatever happens in our families, whatever happens in our ecclesias, whatever conflicts develop, he is in control. It's not up to us to solve all those things, any more than these Jews could have solved the whole problem. What we have to do is our part. We have to go through and faithfully play out our part in patience and in kindness and in compassion to other people, and God will do the rest. We don't have to make things happen. We don't have to get in there, and you see this in ecclesial conflict sometimes, where brethren get together or sisters, and they think, well, I can't let this happen in the ecclesia. And we think, well, I have to force this to make sure this issue gets accomplished. And then we go about doing it the wrong way. We're unkind to people. We mistreat people. We work behind people's backs, and we backtalk about them, and we create situations our kids find out about, and they think, that's how Christadelphians live? Do you really want to be a part of this group when people behave like that? And instead, we have to faithfully, with kindness and compassion, present our case and let God do the rest. He'll take care of it. It's his ecclesia. It's his family. It's his family. It's not ours. All those children that we have, you know, that are out there right now, they're not our children, they're His. And we pray that they will be His, and He'll choose to work with them. And if we keep that perspective right, then all these troubles that we run into, the fires that come and test our faith, we'll believe that God will get it done, and we won't feel like we have to force an issue and do it the wrong way. Because when we do it, that's the problem, is we end up doing it the wrong way, and we end up creating conflict and strife. So as this vision continues on in Zechariah chapter 2, you'll notice that what he gets to next is he sends it in verse 7 to up Zion, escape when you dwell with the daughter of Babylon. And the warning that comes out at this point, to flee out of Babylon. Now, if that's the case, and Zechariah is given this vision, and he's presenting this vision to people down in the land, what that must mean is that the people in the land were somehow going to send the message up to the Jews that were still up in Babylon. God wanted to get them out of Babylon. That's what he intended to do. He said, look, now the time is right. You had to read the signs and realize he's provided an opportunity through Cyrus's decree, and now through the decree that's going to come from Darius Hystaspes, go ahead and finish this temple. And what he's trying to do is get the Jews in Babylon to come back to the land. They don't want to. They were up there for 70 years, and they did what Jeremiah said. They built houses. They had lands. And they married and had wives and had kids. And some of them were very well established, especially the ones who were highly educated. They became incorporated into Babylonian life up there. And when Ezra came down in Ezra chapter 7, and he hears word, and he says, oh, the temple's finished. And so old man Ezra realizes he can come down now and operate in the temple. So in the seventh year of Darius Hystaspes, he comes down the year after the temple's finished, and he gets together a group of people with permission from the king, and he meets at the river Ahava, and he checks around with all the people he's bringing, and he says, all right, how many priests and Levites we got? None. None of them wanted to come because they were so well established. They had a comfortable life up there. They didn't want to come down to Babylon or come out of Babylon and go down to Israel. You think we want to go down there with you? You're going down to that temple? You think they're going to take care of us down there? We know what it was like before. We're depending on the people to bring in the tithes. We're depending on faithfulness from the community to survive. They didn't do that back in Nehemiah's time. They didn't do that. You know, it was very troubling to these people. They were right. They were depending on faith that somehow this was going to work. Remember what happened at the end of Nehemiah? As soon as Nehemiah, after he builds the walls and he's in the land, and he goes up to the governor, you know, later on in the 32nd year, and he reports back to the king. And while he's gone, remember what Eliashib, the high priest, did? He took the very room in the temple where they were supposed to store the tithes and all the things for the priests, and he gives it over to Tobiah. And all the priests and Levites got out of there, and they figured, this is hopeless, you know, and this is what would go on. So no wonder they didn't want to come down. It was going to require faith on their part to do it. So, you know, this was the problem that they were running into. So God's saying, look it, I'm going to shake the nations at this point. I'm going to bring you back, and many nations as well as you will be joined to the Lord, and God will dwell in your midst in Jerusalem. So, you know, it's a very similar thing. Again, you see the tie-ins later on to Revelation. You know, you'll see these in Zechariah all the time. Get out of Babylon, Revelation 18, you know, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins and lest you receive of her plagues. This prophecy in Zechariah is the basis for many of the events that you'll see in the book of Revelation. So at this point, only 42,000 had returned. Only 74 of those were even Levites when they originally came back with Joshua and Zerubbabel. And then when Ezra brought the people back, he had a lot of trouble convincing any of the Levites to return. You actually find out that he made an appeal. He sent out somebody and said, gather some Levites for me. And so he got about 30 of them that were willing to come back. But it was very troubling to get the people to return to the land at that time. You go back and look at what it would take. I mean, just to, once you got back to the land, it would depend on the faithfulness of the people to support the priests and the Levites. But you look at how long the journey was. You're looking at when you leave from these areas back in here and you come on back to the land, we know that the safe route was to go all the way up the Euphrates River, sort of like Abraham did, and come on down from the top. But that's like a 1,000-mile journey, and they walked it back then. They weren't driving in cars and flying in airplanes and that kind of thing. We think we had a rough time getting here, and it might have taken us 9 hours or whatever. You know, back then, you're looking at months to get there in order to do those journeys. When Ezra actually went and Nehemiah, they came back and they did the dangerous route. The dangerous route was shorter, but you had to do the shortcut through here. And in this area up in here, this is where the robbers would lay in wait to try to steal things. And that was the problem for going with the shortcut. So just the very journey itself required faith, and then it depended on the faithfulness of the people that you believed that God was going to work with them in order to provide you with a manner of income and to support your lifestyle back then. So when you look at all the reasons why the Jews didn't want to come back, you can pile them all up. It was a lot easier to just stay where they were. It was a long journey to go back to Israel, and it was probably more than the 600 miles there. The land was a mess. It had been run down for 70 years. There was all kinds of rubble scattered all over the place. Everything was run down. It would be a lot of work to set up. It wasn't like coming here to a Bible school and moving into a cabin right there or whatever you've got, or carrying your RV with you and you just sort of bring your portable home with you. And God had set drought and famine and economic trouble on the land. You find out from Haggai chapter 1. It was not a pleasant place to come to. You had to have the faith to believe that if God says go back, if he wants us to do it, he will take care of us. And this was the situation. A lot of the Levites didn't trust these people. But that's what we're being asked to do, brothers and sisters. Before God invites us into his family forever and he grants us immortality, he has to find out if we trust him. When he gives us immortality, he's not going to take it back. So he's finding out now in our life today, through all the fires that he brings into our life, through the trials, through the chastening that he brings, through our family circumstances, our ecclesial situations, and our worldwide community, he's trying to find out if we trust him. Do we really believe he's in control? And will we really do his way no matter what happens with us? He has to find that out before he hands out immortality. We're not going to just become different people because we're immortal. He's going to take the devil out of us, but we're not going to just become a different personality, a different kind of person because we're all of a sudden immortal. This is the practice time to find out if we're ready for his kingdom. And this is what he's trying to do. He's running us through the trials of life to find out if we really will trust him. And he did this with these people as well. So what he did at this point in time through Haggai, he said, look it, consider how you fared in the past. And in Haggai, he says, from this day forward, you watch. If you get back to work, start today, you watch how I'll bless you. And he does. He brings economic prosperity. He provides money from all those people, from those nations around and the taxes. He just fills the land of Israel with food and with economic prosperity because the people got back to work. This is what he was waiting to see. In Zechariah 2 here, he's promising, I'll protect your cities. I'll be the wall of fire for you. You won't have to worry about soldiers. I'll take care of that for you. He promised in Zechariah 2 here, I will dwell in your midst. I'm going to be there. You're not going to be alone. I'm going to be there with you, and I will protect your city. And then he raises up Haman later on to make them face the reality of the destruction in a foreign land. I really think that was like God's gentle push to all those people up in Babylon still, up in Persia, who weren't willing to come down with Ezra. He gave them one more chance and said, all right, Haman's situation, it's a warning. You got to watch the signs. It's like he gives us the warnings today, and we see all these events in Israel. But at some point, the warnings are over. And God says, I've warned you enough. I gave you the opportunity. I wanted to see if you would respond. And at some point, that time is up. And Christ will come back. And then he's going to look and see, well, how have we done? How have we done with the time that he's given us? But in his kindness and in his patience, he constantly gives us warnings and he gives us gentle pushes. When you look at the phrase in Zechariah chapter 2, how he predicted that many nations would be joined to him, it's fun to watch the initial fulfillment of where this actually did occur. If you go back to Ezra chapter 6, in Ezra chapter 6, when they started working on the walls of the temple, and they were laying the foundations and getting it done, and the temple was done, and they had their great celebration time. The children of Israel, who had returned from the captivity, in Ezra 6 at verse 21, it says they ate together with all who had separated themselves from the filth of the nations of the land in order to seek the Lord God of Israel. Oh, isn't that interesting? that because of what the Jews were doing and their faithfulness to like getting this temple done and trusting in their God to do it, and the other nations watching how God used them, they were his witnesses to the other nations around that their God is powerful. You look at what he's done for them in the midst of all this conflict and trouble. Their God took care of them. He changed the Persian king. He provided a mechanism for them to finish this and get paid for it. There were Gentiles in those nations all around Israel who joined unto the Jews at this time. And they kept the Feast of Unleavened Bread for 7 days with joy, for the Lord had made them joyful and had turned the heart of the king of Assyria toward them to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. See, when you see those phrases like that, the God of Israel or the Lord God of Israel, those are little flag words back then of letting us realize. I don't think they always go back to Jacob like we were looking at last night. I actually think they're warnings to us and they're indicators that these were Gentiles that had come into the community. I even wondered that a bit about Jabez last night when I was looking at that in the Chronicles record. And you read about him and being incorporated into Judah and being in the family of Judah. The very next person that's mentioned in that next section, do you see who was next? Is Caleb. Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, who got incorporated into the tribe of Judah as a Gentile. It's interesting that concept about the fact that God was always bringing in Gentiles, bringing them in to let the community realize we don't have an exclusive right to God's family. He's going to bring in other people from all around to join his family. And you'll see that happening back here in Ezra chapter 6, where it was just like a foreshadowing of what was going to go on in the kingdom age. But in this case, the very little work of building this temple, the temple that these people had decided despise, this day of small things, God used this to draw Gentiles into the community who became faithful members of his family and will probably be in his kingdom. So you find that about the many nations, this prediction that was here in Zechariah chapter 2. It's also there again in Zechariah chapter 8. When you get to Zechariah chapter 8, we're probably around the fourth year of Darius, so you're about 2 years before the temple's finished. And you'll see that the prediction was in Zechariah 8 and verse 20, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, peoples shall yet come, inhabitants of many cities. The inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, let us continue to go and pray before the Lord." They're going to come into Yahweh and seek the Lord of hosts. "I myself will go also. Yes, many peoples and strong nations shall come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem and to pray before the Lord." This was what was happening at that time in a small scale. People were being drawn in from the other nations because the people had gotten back to the work and had faithfully done what God had asked them to. You see what a difference this makes? You look at that in verse 23. "In those days, 10 men from every language of the nation shall grasp the sleeve of a Jewish man, saying, let us go with you, for we've heard that God is with you." Look at the difference between the response of those Gentiles, realizing that these Jews had come back and they had joined together and they were united as a group. They were working together as one man and building God's house. And the Gentiles were drawn to them because of what they saw in the community. What a different spirit than we put forward to the Gentiles today, brothers and sisters, when we sit in conflict, when we have ecclesial arguments, when our community is so divided, and we find we cannot solve these problems. See, the reason it was so successful back then is because they were on the same page. They were working together. The Gentiles came in and saw a group of people who were all working together like angels, and they were working in God's family. This is what they witnessed. And it drew people to the truth. I've actually heard situations in our community today. Well, there's so much conflict in our community. Somebody says, "Well, I've got an interested friend in my neighborhood, but I don't want to bring him to the ecclesia because I don't want him to see all the conflict going on. I don't want him to see what's happening." That's terrible, brothers and sisters. And here's the other possibility. These people were working together, appreciating each other, working in God's service to get a project done, and Gentiles were drawn to this. And I bet their kids were too, because the kids are the same way. They see these things. And that's what these witnessing projects do. It's good to have ecclesial projects like this. Arranging board should go home and think about what can we do to have projects where the ecclesia can work together. Families need to do this. Mom and dad, when you plan family activities so that the family can work together and people can learn how to work together in a united group and others can see the difference that it makes, that the truth makes in our lives. Now, when you look at the long-term fulfillment of this prophecy, brothers and sisters, and you look at, well, what would this mean for the future? Because now we've got the past. I think the past fulfillment is really pretty clear in Zechariah chapter 2. So you look at the long-term. What's actually going to happen in the long run? Well, Christ will come back to these Jews, and he will refine one-third that's in the land, and he will be a wall of fire to them. The Arabs will not run in there and overrun them anymore. The northern nation coming down from the north, the Russia, and all its confederacy is not going to scare them anymore. God will be a wall of fire around Jerusalem, and he will protect it. And then he will use them to conquer the world. The Jews are going to be called to Israel from the four corners of the earth, just like the call back then, and get out of Babylon and come back down to the land. And Jerusalem will be blessed with many peoples and animals. And the Gentile nations will see what God has done with Israel. And many Gentile nations will be drawn to be converted in the kingdom age because of what God has done with his community. Some will rebel and they will have to be conquered, but many of them will be drawn to Jesus Christ because of what he's done for his community. Now, in Zechariah, in the last few minutes, I just want to at least introduce the next vision in Zechariah chapter 3, and then we'll probably finish it up tomorrow. But Zechariah 3 is actually quite a long one. It's got some interesting history to it. In Zechariah 3, he sees the fourth vision, and he sees Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to oppose him. And the Lord said to Satan, "The Lord rebuke you, Satan, and the Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is this not a brand plucked from the fire?" And now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and was standing before the angel. So then he says to him, he answered, he spoke those who stood by him, and he said, "Take away the filthy garments from him," from Joshua. So he says to the angels, "Angel, take away those filthy garments from him. Change his clothes." And he said to him, "See, I have removed your iniquity from you, and I will clothe you with rich robes." And I said, "Let them put a clean turban on his head too." You know, that's interesting. Zechariah would pop that in there. So they put a clean turban on his head and they put clothes on him. And the angel of the Lord stood by. Now, can you see where this is headed? Why is Joshua standing there with all these filthy clothes on? What's he been doing? He's supposed to be the high priest. He's supposed to have those garments of glory and beauty. But what's he been doing? He's building the temple. He doesn't just say, "Everybody else build for me." He's down there doing the work. He got involved day by day. He's down there carrying away the rubble, helping to put the stone. He's doing what he can to get this project done. And he's filthy, dirty. Now, I think we get dirty out here and all the dust that's out here. You get involved in that project, he would be filthy. And he's not at all operating like he's supposed to. He's supposed to be the high priest of Israel. He should have had the beauty, glory garments on and be, you know, all fancy and dressed up and go around the nation and operate as high priest. And he can't do that because he's trying to get the house done. And God's promise is the day's going to come, Joshua, when I'm going to change your clothes. And you, Joshua, you are going to be the high priest of Israel. Not some period down the line, 20, 30, 50 years, whatever. It's going to happen in your day. So that's what Zechariah saw in this vision. And as you keep on going down, you see the stone that comes as well. So when you try to analyze, well, what is this? Well, the Satan in this case would have represented those that had been opposing the Jews. This would be the Samaritans that had hired counselors, caused all this trouble. They were moved into Israel by Azar Haydn way back years ago. They really didn't know about Yahweh, and then they had to send a priest up there to teach them about Yahweh, the God of the Jews. And they opposed this whole building of the temple. In Ezra 4, they had discouraged the Jews and caused them trouble in their building. In Ezra 5, remember, they were the ones that collected the names and tried to intimidate the leaders and said, "We're going to find out your names and report them to the king." And they tried to stop the building of God's house. Now, this vision is like a court scene. You've got the angel of the Lord standing there, and Joshua's right there in front of him, and there's Satan on the side trying to oppose him. And it's like there's a court scene going on, and there's going to be a decision made. There's a verdict that's going to come out of this. So the angel of the Lord is the judge. Joshua and Satan are standing there, and there's other angels that are there in this court scene as well. And so when the angels listen to what's happening and they look at the situation, the verdict comes out, and the angel of the Lord says, "The Lord rebuke you." That's what he says. "The Lord rebuke you." Now, you look at how this picked up in Jude 1. In Jude's letter, the most unlikely place you'd ever expect for this to occur. In Jude 1, the context in Jude is that you were having people that had crept into the ecclesia to cause trouble. And what was happening in ecclesial life then is that there was all this conflict going on. People were yelling at each other, screaming at each other, you know, doing all kinds of nasty things with one another. And Jude steps in and says, look at, you know, we can't be like this. The faithful have to represent God. You have to live like a member of God's family. And so what Jude does, which I find really fascinating, is when he's talking about this ecclesial trouble and the conflict that goes on, you can imagine sometimes at ecclesial business meetings or whatever, Jude says, look it, yet Michael the archangel, in disputing or contending with the devil, when he disputed about the body of Moses, because he refers to Joshua's community there as the body of Moses that had come out of Egypt, he dared not bring against them a reviling accusation, but said, the Lord rebuke you. Right out of Zechariah chapter 3. Now, do you see what Jude is doing? He's using the angels. The archangel Michael, who's the most powerful angel on our planet, and he says, look at brethren and sisters, here's the guy who has the power, the most power of all. And when he gets into a situation where there's conflict in the group, he doesn't yell and scream. He doesn't bring a reviling accusation. What he does is he goes to God and he says, Yahweh, rebuke you. Because he knows God's in control. This is what God's family members do. Do you realize that Jude would take the behavior of an angel and then use that as his basis for telling us how to behave in ecclesial life? I find that really fascinating to realize. It makes you go back over the whole Bible then and start looking at, wow, what did we miss? What did we miss about the behavior of angels where God was trying to teach us about how to live in his family? And Jude is the proof that this is what they're there for. They're teaching us how to behave. You know, it's like Jesus Christ. When he was reviled, he didn't revile in return. And when this angel's watching this, he doesn't revile. He doesn't say to the Samaritans, what's the matter with you, you crazy people? Who do you think you are? And talk to him like that. He says, Yahweh rebuke you. That's it. And he leaves it in God's hands to control it. And he never, never steps over the line of failing to represent the character of God. I find that one of the most fascinating concepts in the Bible. I think you can learn from this as well, though, that this angel of the Lord in this case, when you look at who it is, at least Jude tells us it's Michael. So you can Bible mark that back into Zechariah 3, and so we do. But really, what you want to Bible mark out of the whole thing, and what you want to go away remembering, is that the behavior of angels, the way they behave, is the way God expects us to behave. In marriage relationships, and in family situations, with children, with your parents, with parents with your children, in ecclesial conflict situations, you have to watch how angels behave and treat one another like we really believe God is in control and it's not up to me to force an issue. This is what God's family members do. And if you're going to be invited into God's family, you have to learn to live like that. He's not going to bring people in who are the in-charge people who have to have it their way, nobody else's way. That isn't what God's after in his family. We have angels who tell other angels who tell other angels, and they follow directions. This is what goes on in God's family. And they just cooperate like that. This is the practice time to be a member of that family. And I think it's fun to watch there in Jude when he actually references in verse 23 when he talks about that others are going to be saved with fear and pulling them out of the fire, hating even the garment defiled by the flesh. You're going to see that that's picked up here in Zechariah chapter 3. So you look at the sad state that was going on at this time, at the beginning of this vision at least. Joshua's the high priest of Israel. He has no temple to work in. He's filthy from the work of the temple. He didn't have his glorious garments that were for beauty. And the adversaries were committed to make him fail. And what God was telling through this vision is this was for Joshua, he's called. He says, Zechariah would come in and say, Joshua, here's what I saw last night. God promises that your dirty clothes, you're going to have a shower. You're going to be all cleaned up. You're going to put on your glorious garments for beauty. You are going to operate as high priest of this community because this house is going to get done in your day and you will be our high priest. And that would have been really encouraging to those people at that time. But the key, brothers and sisters, was to remember that God is in control. It's his family. It's his ecclesia. Our job is to do our part. But as we do our part, God's more interested in how we do it than the end result. He can bring about the end result anytime he wants. And he's using all the experiences of our family life, our ecclesial life, to challenge us and to discipline us so that we'll learn to trust him. And he's waiting to see if we respond and we learn to live like the angels, that we learn to practice the compassion, the kindness, and the mercy of our God.